the fight for the larger truth is ultimately undermined to such a degree that now the Rolling Stone article is ammunition in the fight for a larger lie.
Rolling Stone magazine is confronted with its journalistic sins, but the toll of the fabricated rape story will endure. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also on this week's show, another shocking rape narrative, this one possibly underreported.
The actual substance of the report is that roughly 50 girls were raped by U.S. military personnel and U.S. Contractors with complete immunity.
And beware, California water gluttons, there are apps for shaming you.
People take pictures of other people's use and send them into the city. There are snitch lines in cities including Los Angeles and Long Beach.
There's more coming up. Stay with us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Last fall, after Rolling Stone published her blockbuster expose, A Rape on Campus, this was reporter Sabrina Rubin Erdley on PBS NewsHour.
When I first encountered Jackie, I was absolutely shocked by her story. She went to the administration and told them that she had been gang raped at a fraternity house by seven men while two others watched. And the administration did nothing about it.
Erdley's story described not only an unspeakable assault on the student called Jackie in a fraternity house at the University of Virginia, but the administration's foot-dragging and the prevailing culture of rape on the venerable Charlottesville campus. What immediately followed, however, was skepticism. After inquiries from the Washington Post and Slate, the big story began to unravel. Early this week, the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism released a 12,000-word postmortem commissioned by Rolling Stone, which is a thorough impeachment of the narrative from top to bottom.
Developing off the top at 11, Rolling Stone accused of journalistic failure for the debunked UVA rape story.
Columbia found that the crusading reporter gullibly accepted Jackie's demonstrably porous story, a gruesome tale that happened to validate Erdley's reportorial premise. Along the way, Columbia concluded, Erdley violated basic rules of reporting, casually indicted individuals and institutions without giving them a fair hearing, and, along with her editors, neglected to cross-check damaging assertions and intentionally withheld key information from readers. Though it has now officially retracted A Rape on Campus, Rolling Stone incredibly continues to shift blame onto the troubled Jackie and claim its editorial practices are fundamentally sound. Erdley will still write for Rolling Stone. Nobody has been suspended or fired. To Siva Vaidyanathan, a media studies professor at the University of Virginia, little has been accomplished because, he says, the Columbia J School report glosses over the damage done to individuals, to his university, and most of all, to actual victims of campus rape.
There was real human damage done at the University of Virginia. There were students who, for weeks, could not make sense of the fact that all of a sudden, the place they considered home, their alma mater, seemed vicious, dangerous, cold, that their fellow students, it seemed, were callous in the face of such degradation and pain, that their administrators seemed, as the Rolling Stone article accused them, caring more about the reputation of the university than the pain of a young woman. I mean, those were such over-the-top charges. And coming from a venerable journalistic institution and being written so powerfully with such a sure voice, that generated so much anxiety and so much internal conflict at the university.
The university community includes faculty, students, administration, the local physical community of Charlottesville, and the Commonwealth of Virginia as a whole, and of course, tens of hundreds of thousands of alumni, all of whom were, I assume, horrified by Rolling Stone's report.
In the first few weeks after the Rolling Stone article broke and before it fell apart at the hands of the Washington Post and some real reporting, I had a number of long conversations with alumni, both through social media and in real life. And they were angry at their alma mater. They were deeply hurt. They were calling the president's office. They were withholding donations. They were demanding immediate action. The faculty were also part of that, too. I mean, the faculty were very aggressive in challenging the administration to explain itself. Again, in a moment when the administration was very limited in what it could say, and frankly, in terms of public relations, basically botched the first 2 weeks of the emergency by being sort of ham-handed and lawyerly in the process. Interestingly, the students I talked to at that moment were the ones who raised the first questions about the veracity of the story. They pointed out to me, for instance, you know, fraternities and sororities rush in the spring at UVA, not in the fall. Why would that event have been in the fall? And because a lot of people knew Jackie, there were some suspicions about her state of mind, but nobody wanted to go so far as to say she fabricated, of course. And there were lots of other questions about the students who were supposed to be her friends, who acted so cold and only concerned with their social standing and their invitations to fraternity parties. To my students, that sounded so off, so untrue, that that planted seeds of doubt.
This story did not take place in a vacuum. And it's not as though Eardley chose University of Virginia at random. There is a history that the university has to reckon with, including a song that Eardley wrote about titled Rugby Road, which is kind of a celebration of co-ed rape. Never let a Virginia man an inch above your knee. He'll take you to his fraternity house and fill you full of beer, and soon you'll be the mother of a bastard cavalier. As a journalist, to discover something like that, what more delicious kind of confirmation can you have of your premise? But
none of my students have ever heard those noxious verses of the Rugby Road song. Some of them had heard that they existed. None of them had ever sung it. None of the a cappella groups sing those verses. That was sort of bizarre. And that, I think that was one of the things that drove students to think there was something a little bit off. They're just not part of the culture, or at least haven't been for a couple of decades. You know, look, the University of Virginia was founded by a slaveholder. Slaveholding and rape depended on each other. And so we have to constantly acknowledge that the history of the University of Virginia is one of brutality. We have to do so much better. And part of doing better is recognizing when we have changed. And one of the ways we've changed is nobody sings those verses anymore.
Siva, women are at risk. Young women are at risk. Young women on campus where there is lots of beer and randy young men are at risk. Those are kind of stipulated and are at the bottom of Rolling Stone's crusading attempts to draw light on a structural problem in society. It reminds me that we often hear the notion of, even from journalists, of a greater truth, an emotional truth that trumps the facts. I want to ask you, Professor Vaidyanathan, in an attempt to find a kind of poster child for the abuse of young women on campus, has Rolling Stone found a poster child for the danger of letting the so-called larger truth trump the facts?
To tell a story of a larger truth, you really have to build it up from a set of bricks that contain nuggets of actual truth. You also have to seek the truth rather than impose it. You can't walk into a reporting project convinced that you know what you're talking about and that everything you're about to relate fills in and supports the premise with which you started. If you do that, you're very likely to be led astray in little or big ways. But, you know, in this case, the fight for the larger truth is ultimately undermined to such a degree that now the Rolling Stone article is ammunition in the fight for a larger lie.
Siva, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a media studies professor at the University of Virginia. As we've seen, sometimes a horror story just makes sense. It conforms with history. It sounds true. And then comes a rush to judgment. But there also exists the opposite impulse in the face of explosive allegations, an abundance of caution. One such set of recent accusations has all the makings of a bombshell, yet thus far has scarcely made a ripple. It concerns the alleged serial rape of 54 Colombian children by U.S. military personnel and contractors between 2003 and 2007. The source was a report co-published by the government of Colombia and its enemy of 50 years, the radical leftist revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known by its Spanish acronym FARC. The two parties are in historic peace negotiations, and the report was a truth and reconciliation exercise intended to account for all those killed and displaced by both sides in a half century of dirty war. Buried within the 800 pages of documentation were a few hundred words mentioning the accusations against U.S. personnel. In one case described, Americans actually videoed sexual abuse and sold it as pornography. Literally atrocious. As listener Steve Fernandez wrote, "I was disturbed to read about U.S. soldiers raping young girls, filming the rape, selling the videos as child porn, and held immune from prosecution by the U.S. government. I was also disturbed by the lack of coverage of this by the U.S. mainstream corporate media. Does On the Media also deem this non-newsworthy?" Indeed, in the week after the charges were revealed in the Colombian press, the story found its way only onto Spanish-language sources such as Venezuelan TV network Telesur, the Kremlin propaganda operation Russia Today, and the UK's clickbaity Daily Mail. Then it gravitated to the lefty press, Democracy Now!, The Nation magazine, and The Guardian. And the recent announcement of a U.S. Army investigation has gotten mentions in USA Today and a few other outlets. But as of this writing, the New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, AP, and NPR have remained silent. Adam Johnson, a reporter for the liberal media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, calls the situation a, quote, virtual media blackout.
I just found it curious that no one had mentioned it. The argument I make is that if this report was a Truth and Reconciliation report about China or about Iran or about, you know, Russian soldiers in the Caucasus, this would have been everywhere.
What exactly is the allegation, and what was the evidence supporting it?
The actual substance of the report is that roughly 50 girls between the years 2004 and 2007 were raped by U.S. military personnel and U.S. Contractors with complete immunity. There was lots of evidence. There was lots of testimony that two men had raped a 12-year-old, and they were shipped off to the United States and never heard from again. And so there was basically two things. There's rape, which is obviously difficult to prove in general, and then there was a system of absolute immunity. You can't get a smoking gun when there's not really an investigation or trial. So allegations are pretty much all you have. And when you're going up against a Defense Department with billions in a PR budget and you're going up against editors that don't want you to float conspiracy theories, it may not be as substantive as people like.
Now, you've listed already a number of reasons why major media might shy away from this story, the fuzziness of the allegations. Are there other reasons you suppose that, you know, this has not been splashed across the front page of the New York Times? It's still pretty explosive charge if Americans on government payroll have not just immunity but impunity to rape children on a foreign posting.
If you put it in context, the charges – and I don't want to sound macabre here, but statistically speaking, it would actually be more, I guess, shocking if you had – a military base for decades that had no allegations or no instances of rape, right? One of the reasons I think there was hesitancy was the burden for going up as the United States military is very high. And it's high because people don't want to vaguely cast conspiracy theories, and that's understandable. My argument was, and my argument continues to be, was that the report, even if people thought it wasn't credible, was worth noting because it made such a splash in Spanish language media. And I could have bought the line that maybe it wasn't sourced enough or there needed to be more looking into it until last week when the U.S. Army, based on the report alone, launched its own investigation. So if the report is enough to validate a U.S. Army investigation, I have to assume it's enough to validate a story.
And there you have what we often refer to on this program as the anvil. The press is the hammer, but it needs an anvil to strike against, and that's some sort of official recognition. So now that the military has said it is digging into this case, does that free the press to get busy as well?
Yes, and I think it already has. You've seen reports in USA Today. You saw a report in the International Business Times. Chris Albritton from the Daily Beast, who did, I think, a very detailed, thorough report. I think it's been validated. And it's a chicken and the egg issue too. To what extent does press coverage put pressure on the Army to investigate? I think it absolutely does. I think they were hoping this report came out and nothing really happened of it. But because it caught fire in the Spanish language press and in left-wing media, I think that added pressure to bring the story up.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adam Johnson writes for the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Chris Albritton, whose work Johnson complimented, is covering the Columbia matter for the Daily Beast. The shocking number of alleged child victims, the four-year time span, and a century of U.S. mischief in Latin America got his attention. But mundane obstacles, not a conspiracy of silence, have so far made the story hard to run down.
We tried to move beyond what was just in the report. We tried to get some more information from the Army Criminal Investigation Command. We tried to get some comments from the Colombian government, from the author. We have been unable to reach them as yet. The Good Friday and the Easter holiday really kind of slowed things down for a lot of reporters, I think.
Good Friday or possibly stonewalling? Is there any sense that people are avoiding you?
I mean, it's hard to say in Colombia because, you're dealing with it internationally, and culturally they tend not to answer emails quite as quickly as we do here in the United States or respond to phone calls. And the place really does shut down for quite a few days, both before and after Easter. It's a very important holiday in Colombia, and this happened to fall right on that weekend. I don't get the impression that there's necessarily any stonewalling going on.
And what about the notion of a news blackout? Does that make any sense to you whatsoever?
I don't think it's a conscious decision. The U.S. English language media has traditionally had a kind of blind spot when it comes to Latin America. I don't actually know why. I've always found it rather curious. But for whatever reason, they're just not that interested unless they're regional papers like maybe the Miami Herald or the LA Times who serve a large Spanish-speaking population.
You would think that if there's anything that can penetrate the blind spot, it would be U.S. soldiers raping children.
You would think. This report was a fairly low-key report. It kind of came out in February, I believe. Even some of my reporter friends down there didn't really quite realize it had been released. Columbia Reports, which is kind of an aggregator of media in Colombia, didn't pick it up until last week or so, maybe the week before. And since then, you've started to see it getting picked up. I mean, we've covered it, obviously. Stars and Stripes has covered it. Army Times, USA Today, I believe. So it's not as fast as I think many people would like, but it's definitely starting to get some traction.
Whether we're speaking of a shooting in Pakistan or a rape in Okinawa, there is a long and woeful list of incidents involving American personnel overseas, which is one thing. Mm-hmm. A second thing is diplomatic immunity or any kind of practical impunity for Americans abroad. But then there's a third level, and I wonder if there's any evidence that this gets there, that it's not just an isolated event involving a soldier or two, a contractor or two, but something much more institutional involving larger numbers of soldiers with the authorities' tacit consent. Is there any evidence that the scope of this becomes a kind of Abu Ghraib or a My Lai?
I think that's vastly overstating it. I don't want to minimize this in the least. I mean, these are serious crimes by any standard. But I don't think it rises to the level of number of incidents that would point to some kind of institutional or tacit acceptance of it. I think that these were crimes committed by soldiers who, when they get into a population like Colombia, they decide to take advantage of it. In Abu Ghraib, those guys felt like they were operating under orders. It's a completely, completely different dynamic.
Well, for what it's worth, Abu Ghraib began with kind of whispers that did not coalesce into the full scandal for some while, no?
Well, I was in Iraq when Abu Ghraib first started bubbling up. Rather shamefacedly, I say now, I was certainly guilty of kind of dismissing the complaints of Iraqis who said, well, this is what these soldiers are doing over at Abu Ghraib. And I think a lot of us, you know, were of the mind that, oh, U.S. soldiers wouldn't do that. That's certainly taught me a lesson. You know, I don't have any proof of these 53 other cases, but I think it's worth looking into. I think it's definitely worth listening to what the Colombians are saying and to give them more credence than maybe what we might have, you know, 15 years ago.
Chris, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chris Albritton is a reporter for The Daily Beast. Coming up, scientists, journalists, and you tackle the story of climate change. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For the remainder of this hour, we'll be discussing climate change, literally the most urgent story in human history, yet one the press has struggled to address. How to understand all the science, much less explain it? What's the right amount of advocacy or of skepticism? When to point out political demagoguery on the subject? When to simply record and report the debate? And when to abandon any pretense of neutrality? For Alan Rusbridger, outgoing editor of The Guardian, after 20 years at the helm, the answer to the last question is now. In December, he persuaded colleagues to launch a climate change campaign quickly before he has any regrets that he did not do enough. Here he is in a new Guardian podcast.
So in the new year, I'd like a group of us to meet and brainstorming what exactly we can do to have the most effect. I want the focus to be narrow and forceful.
The ensuing campaign, called Keep It in the Ground, attempts to have a major impact leading to December's UN Climate Change Conference in Paris, and more especially before a 2 degrees Celsius further warming of the planet creates irreversible cataclysm. But he wishes to do this not by warning about atmospheric ruin. The Guardian's campaign is strictly market economics, asking the two largest charitable foundations in the world, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, to divest their billions in fossil fuel investments. And there's a petition, too, because, says Rusbridger, reporting and even scolding have failed to generate enough urgency to save our world.
I think people feel helpless in the face of this story. They see governments finding it very hard to agree on action. And I think they've stopped reading. So one of the purposes of starting a campaign was to give them something to do. And the reaction has been very, very positive. We've had something like 170,000 people who have signed.
Alan, from your podcast called The Biggest Story in the World, here's a clip of the environmentalist and author Bill McKibben proposing a strategy.
A generation ago, when the biggest moral issue in the world was apartheid in South Africa, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu suggested this tactic, that it was time for the great institutions of the West to cut their economic ties with companies that propped up the apartheid regime.
A democratic and free society.
If there's ever going to be any kind of international agreement, it'll only be because our political and business leaders are feeling unrelenting pressure from all over the world.
The anti-apartheid model, was that the aha moment for your team?
The common link is Desmond Tutu, who's very involved in the divestment from fossil fuels campaign. McKibben heads this protest movement called 350.org, has successfully moved the needle. He has persuaded some very big funds to divest and is creating movement in an area where otherwise we all have to sit back and wait for the political leaders to go to Paris and do something, which they might or they might not. But I think they're unlikely to move unless they feel the hot wind of public interest on their necks.
Then there was the question of how many organizations to try to nudge to your way of thinking, and you opted for only two, Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation. What were those debates like?
this is not a hostile thing aimed at Gates or Wellcome at all. They, above all, understand the health risks and the scientific risks, and we thought it was more likely that they would listen to argument.
Although, no luck so far.
Well, the dialogue is literally a few weeks old. At the moment, they say they disagree. Gates say they have an obligation to maximize their revenues. Well, we'll look at what kind of returns they're getting compared with what they would be if they weren't in fossil fuels and what kind of risks in the future they're willing to bear. And Wellcome are essentially saying it's better to engage with these companies. Well, we will press them for examples of what engagement looks like. I mean, there's been one win so far, which is that we realized that the moment we started writing about this, people would look at the Guardian Media Group, that's the company which administers the Guardian on behalf of the Scott Trust, and they would say, well, what about your own investments?
Yeah, physician, heal thyself.
Well, quite, and I thought that was a fair point. I went to the Guardian Media Group before we started the campaign and said, look, you should know we're going to be writing about this. People will ask. And last week, the Guardian Media Group decided that they were going to divest. And they said they weren't doing that on moral grounds. They said they were doing that on hard-headed business grounds.
That fossil fuel assets will eventually become unusable and therefore worthless. So it's not just scientists crying, run for your lives. You're saying to investors, run for your lives.
There's simply too much fossil fuel in the world. We can't safely burn it and stay within the 2 degrees that everyone agrees is the outer limit of what we can allow. And so this stuff can never be burned. And I think once the penny drops with the people who control funds, they will want to not be part of an owning class of stranded assets. They will want to get rid of it. I think it's interesting that people like, you know, the governor of the Bank of England and the head of the World Bank are beginning to wave a big red flag about what they see as a likely bubble. And this would be a bubble like no other bubble that we've experienced before. If humanity is to act, it's better that it acts sooner because the cost of acting later is going to be exponentially greater. It may not win quickly in the time I'm editor, but I'm sure this battle to keep it in the ground will be won.
Do you have any evidence that the public is tuned out on this, as you call it, biggest story in the world? Have the forces of climate denial managed to turn this not into a scientific question but a political one, forcing citizens to just tune out the usual suspects on one side saying one thing and the supposed skeptics on the other side saying another thing, and everybody just goes back to business as usual?
Anecdotally speaking to a lot of journalists, not on The Guardian, but on other news organizations, they've admitted privately that they haven't given up on it. Of course, they go on reporting it, but they find it very difficult to find new ways of animating. There are only so many pictures of polar bears on ice caps that you can use. I think finding a way of people sitting up and taking notice is a perfectly valid journalistic thing. When the science is really so settled, that is sufficiently beyond any reasonable doubt that it seems to me there's no point in arguing about that. We might move straight on to the political and economic consequences and possibilities of doing something about it.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Alan Rusbridger is the editor of The Guardian. Its campaign to push the Gates Foundation and Wellcome Trust to divest from fossil fuels is called Keep It in the Ground. When it comes to affecting environmental change, starving big energy of capital is one method, but there are others, including good old-fashioned finger-pointing. As California enters its fourth year of a historic drought, the search is on for who is most to blame. For instance, viewed from the outside, the problem is California's very Californianess. Author Stephen Johnson, writing in Medium's Matter magazine, called it, quote, apocalyptic schadenfreude, the tone of some national media coverage that points to lush lawns and golf courses to suggest something shameful and drought-deserving.
The view from above is stunning, but in Palm Springs, residents consume 3 times more water than the state average.
But among Californians themselves, there is so much more nuance to the assessment of blame. Northern versus southern, agricultural versus residential, neighbor versus neighbor. In social media, the phenomenon is known as drought shaming, where anyone can be flamed for misusing or just using water. There's a hashtag, there are municipal hotlines, There are even, yes, apps for that. Molly Peterson of KPCC Southern California Public Radio describes one such drought-shaming app called VizSafe.
It's a crowdsourced tool that allows people to record and share a report from their phone and pass it on to other people.
This guy is watering the street.
It's so frustrating. Look at all this water they've wasted or are wasting.
Local media especially has well enjoyed taking pictures of sprinklers that spill onto pavement and outdoor landscape watering, especially when it comes to, say, the City of Los Angeles Department of Recreation and Parks has taken some big hits in local television media about this. This just now democratizes that process and allows everybody to point out somebody else's wrong actions to everybody else.
Central Valley is America's fruit basket, if not bread basket. It's using 80% of the water for agriculture. Has the shaming extended to industrial agriculture as well, or is it just, you know, in the backyards of Palos Verdes?
It sure as heck has. I mean, talk to an almond farmer. Almonds are the poster child for a heavy water footprint in California right now. And the case of the almond is far more complex than you'd be led to believe if you read about almonds as this terrible water-sucking thing all of the time. But they're not the only water-hogging crop. There's other tree nuts. There's stone fruits. We grow rice in California. We grow alfalfa in California. It seems really kind of reductive. I feel a twinge of regret at all the reduction of California to just being a terrible almond-growing state when there's so much demand for these products in the rest of the world.
I read a Stephen Johnson piece in Medium that says, if every single Southern Californian uprooted and moved to Seattle, it would not have the same effect on the overall water usage as the Central Valley simply reducing its irrigation by 10%. Is a statewide 25% mandatory cutback on individuals really going to solve a problem that is rooted in the agriculture economy of Central California?
Well, it might solve a problem that's sort of created by the way we think about water in the West generally. When I was in law school, I studied a lot about water law in the West in California, and we read a lot of Wallace Stegner. And there's a quote I always remember. He said something like, the West cannot carry what it has lifted. It's going to make heroic efforts in the direction of grandiose engineering works. And in the end, the West will subside back to what was meant to be this oasis civilization with one great deficiency, water. And we're able to ignore that discussion most of the time in California for a variety of reasons. Some of them have to do with large cities and some of them have to do with agriculture. If people have to confront their relationship with water in a different way because fundamentally water's presence in our lives is changing as a result of climate in the long term or as a result of drought in the near term, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing.
All right. So there's internecine shaming. But then there's also shaming from the outside. Very recently, the New York Times showed these overhead shots of the Southern California landscape dotted with swimming pools and extremely lush lawns hard by the kind of natural desert that otherwise would be there, inviting readers to say, tisk, 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 you people have always been profligate. You're taking away natural resources in order to create an unnaturally green environment. At long last, the chicken has come home to roost.
As a Californian, I'm not saying that you shouldn't ask questions about agriculture, but when an image like that simplifies an incredibly complex, biodiverse, ecologically diverse state into dirt and golf courses. And that's not at all what California is. We've got this incredibly complex array of large cities and small, big users and small, even within the same city. The oversimplification of the Western United States and the Southwestern United States by journalists from points east is not new to the drought. It's frustrating, I think, as a Californian, when we more correctly understand this as an issue of rich versus poor, of the ability of people like Oprah in Montecito, which is a very fancy enclave in Santa Barbara County, to truck in water at a cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars and ignore all these watering restrictions and just behave as very rich private citizens can. When there are people who are using less water a day than Boston, which is a very good water-conserving city, or New York.
I did notice that on your Twitter feed, you called out a Midwesterner using the hashtag drought shaming and came to the defense of your state. Tell me about it.
There was someone from the Midwest who kind of expressed what I had earlier expressed, which was shock that Southern California had actually used more water in February compared to the February before the drought in 2013. And I pointed out that some cities in Southern California, namely the one in which I live, had actually dropped water use during that time. I shoveled the blame further south towards San Diego. And I got a great response from the Midwesterner who pointed out that they build in a floodplain in Ohio. So everyone is not without something to be shamed for.
Has anyone from San Diego doxed you or keyed your car?
Not yet, but it's so far away and they have such great burritos and some great waves down there. I can't imagine they'd get in their car till at least the weekend.
Molly, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bob.
Molly Peterson covers the environment for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Coming up, scientists want to help journalists help you understand the nitty-gritty of climate change. This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In the arena of climate change coverage, there's often a gap between science-based facts and what is actually reported. This sometimes has to do with confusion, sometimes with oversimplification, sometimes with zeal. If only the errors could be quickly flagged and corrected by actual scientists. Well, aha. Now comes a project called Climate Feedback, a collective of accredited climate scientists who use a browser plugin to annotate climate journalism online. Emmanuel Vincent is the project's founder and a researcher at the University of California Merced's Center for Climate Communication.
All right, so the process in our project is to have scientists go online and annotate the news and say what they think about the trustworthiness of the news right there in the same web browser. So we have a new tool for that, which is called the Hypothesis plugin, that allows anyone to annotate a piece of text online. And we, in our project, invite scientists to use this tool to give feedback on the accuracy of the news, but they could also provide more context and give their insight.
So can you give me an example of how the plugin might work?
So one of the stories we annotated was in the Wall Street Journal, and it was written by Bjorn Lomborg. And in that case, I think most of the scientists had serious issue with the accuracy of many scientific facts that were mentioned. For instance, he says that the sea levels are rising, but the rise is not accelerating. And this is quoted as a good news. And in this case, the scientists bring a figure saying that if you not just look at the few last years, but look at the decade-long record of sea level rise we have, you don't see much of a deceleration. You more see the rate of rise of sea level just keeps going up and up. If you have a problem and the problem persists, then it's not such a good news to just say that it's not accelerating.
Did the Wall Street Journal issue a clarification or a correction or in any way change its text, which of course lives online in perpetuity?
No, not that I know. So we had more an interaction with Bjorn Lomborg in another journal, and he replied to our comments. But most of the time, journalist issues are not about getting the facts wrong. It's more for instance, about cherry picking. So you can have correct facts, but you ignore another part of the data that would go against your story. And in that case, it's not just fact-checking that needs to be done. It's also bringing more context. But another aspect that we would like to foster, too, is to bring scientists in a closer contact with journalists. So to make it easier for journalists to find resources deemed accurate by scientists, and also to find experts in the field that they are speaking about.
Now, one problem that we haven't discussed, isn't reportorial bias or ignorance, but audience bias and ignorance. The scientific truth about climate change in particular has been so successfully politicized. Is there any level of annotation that will defeat preconceived notions of the reader?
I think in the case of preconceived notions of the reader, our project may not be the most efficient way of speaking to people who really don't want to trust scientists. Our audience is maybe more people who are willing to hear about what the scientists have to say, but may be confused because there is so much contradictory information online. One of the objectives that we have is that indeed readers change maybe their habit when they are reading something in the news. And if they see our comments once on a report, they may think, hey, scientists have got something to say about what I read in the news. So next time I run into a piece, maybe I will ask myself the question, has this information checked by scientists? Is it consistent with what scientists really think? So maybe that could be a first step that readers develop critical thinking. You want to have people critical not just of what they don't like to hear, but about everything. And you also want them to have a reference that is the scientific body of knowledge, not just the people that they trust and they like to hear about.
Emmanuel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emmanuel Vincent is the founder of Climate Feedback, a group of climate scientists annotating climate journalism online. The first two official candidates for president have thrown their hats into the ring, which is dangerous because their scalps are now exposed to deadly ultraviolet rays. But both Republican senators, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, have said they don't believe that baloney anyway. They're on-the-record climate change denialists, raising some journalistic challenges for the coming campaign. Here's Ted Cruz last month on Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Satellite data demonstrate for the last 17 years, there's been zero warming, none whatsoever. It's why, you remember how it used to be called global warming? And then magically the theory changed to climate change?
Sure.
The reason is it wasn't warming, but the computer models still say it is, except the satellites show it's not.
Wait, what? Cruz's claim sounded fishy to Washington Post energy and environment reporter Chris Mooney.
Mooney actually called up one of the guys who does those satellite measurements and said, you know, does this interpretation of your work sound right to you? And the guy said, no, of course not. That's ridiculous.
That's David Roberts, a staff writer for the environmental news site Grist.org. When a candidate cites science to validate climate change denial, Roberts says, one journalistic tactic is to go to the source and see if the science is being warped. But that doesn't happen so often. As NYU media critic Jay Rosen recently blogged, denialist views are often reported just like any other campaign position, with no attempt to compare them to, you know, reality, which David Roberts agrees is a dereliction of journalistic duty.
At the very least, just note, Ted Cruz is wrong about this. As a journalist, if you're telling your audience over and over again that a politician is lying, at some point the audience has to care and respond, especially in U.S. campaign journalism. If you become the guy or gal who is always pestering people about climate change and asking these annoying follow-ups, pushing and pushing and pushing, pretty soon you're going to develop a reputation as a crusader. At a certain point, as a journalist, you need outside events to push climate onto the agenda, and then you can respond. But asking journalists to be the ones that push it onto the agenda might be sort of overloading journalists with more responsibility than they can handle.
Well, it's a structural conflict you're describing. The journalist's responsibility to be advocates of truth versus the anathema to most American journalists, at least, to be seen as an advocate for a point of view or a political position.
You know, if you're a journalist, how do you treat a candidate who says that the UN, through Agenda 21, is trying to establish world government via building bike paths in small American towns? That's ridiculous, too. Or death panels in Obamacare? Or what about the theory put forward by Dick Cheney, one of the most prominent Republicans in the world, that Obama's foreign policy is not merely weakening America, but that Obama has a secret plan deliberately to weaken and destroy America because of his whatever Kenyan colonialist. I mean, you know, these things are all transparently absurd, but they're also very widely believed in one political party and not the other. So how do you go around as a journalist saying these things are transparently absurd without appearing to be siding with one of the political parties?
You know, Jay Rosen suggested one, I think, kind of cynical option. I think he thinks it's cynical as well. He calls it savvy analysis. I call it the Politico approach. And that is to play it all as a horse race story, as a strategy and tactic story, as opposed to facing the underlying reality.
I mean, even more stories like that about climate would be better than no stories about climate, right? But the problem is that climate doesn't even really give good material for that kind of story because the political analysis is simple. If you're on the right, you deny it. And if you're on the left, you have to, you know, notionally support doing something about it. It's a clean, polarized issue. So there aren't even really good strategy stories. That's been true for a while now. I do think it's actually changing. I do think climate is starting to sort of organically push itself into the news more often now. This is what environmentalists have been waiting for decades. The interesting political question now, and this I think is an interesting question for journalists too, what do you do if Republicans just don't want to talk about the science at all, refuse to discuss it, and just focus on saying that any regulations are going to destroy the economy, which is much more familiar ground for them?
Ted Cruz isn't a scientist, and I'm not an economist. I know Paul Krugman has spittle flying from his mouth when that argument is broached because he says there's absolutely no evidence, none whatsoever, that any previous government regulation on clean air and clean water, you know, have ever created any kind of doom or even harm to the economy.
And this is, I think, actually a journalistic failing that is in some ways longer standing and more corrosive than whatever journalistic failings you have around climate science, which is, you know, as long as I've been paying attention, every time a new regulation is proposed, literally every time, conservatives and business say it's going to destroy the economy, we're going to have to close a bunch of businesses, it's going to cause blackouts or reliability problems. And then the regulation is passed and the economy continues growing and the air gets cleaner and people get sick less and the economic doom never materializes. But then you move to the next episode, a new regulation is proposed, they say the same thing, and journalists never seem to let that record of error affect the way they judge the new question. It's as though every time we face this question, we're starting all over again. And I think it's just because there's never consensus in economics the way there is in physical sciences. So it's always he said, she said, forever and ever, amen.
And therefore, I propose another tack that journalists could take, which also hinges on a conservative article of faith. And that is when a candidate denies climate change or says it's too expensive to address. You could say, is it the president's primary role to protect the American public from all threats, foreign and domestic? Why, of course it is. Well, then, why are you against regulating fossil fuels, the burning of which will kill our children's children and make America uninhabitable?
What about the Pentagon? What about the military? I mean, the Pentagon now has released several reports saying that climate change is going to be the number one driver of resource conflicts and forced migrations around the world, and that a destabilized world is going to be dangerous for America, and therefore it is a national security imperative to address this. At a certain point, you get, they call it epistemic closure. You're just so convinced of your position that there is no such thing as counter evidence. And I think a lot of conservatives are just so dug in on this, I honestly don't know what could shift it.
I guess about the time the East River is part of the ocean, that might do the trick.
Well, it's funny. You know, one of the states that's most directly and immediately threatened by climate change is Florida. And as a matter of fact, sea levels have already risen enough that Miami is being regularly partially flooded now. And so there's this question of what's Miami going to do about it? But, you know, Florida has a Republican governor that has more or less forbidden state officials from talking about climate. And so literally you're going to see a state go underwater even as it flails in denial like this. And you sort of have to wonder, like, what amount of evidence will do it?
So it's like the Black Knight, David, from Monty Python.
It's only a flesh wound, right?
It's only a flesh wound. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Roberts is a staff writer for grist.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.